This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of ZCNYC. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to those of you who are new. My name is Hojin. Glad to be here at the temple. And happy Mother's Day to everyone. From the Tibetan tradition, it's said that all of us have been mothers at some point. Today, in honor of Mother's Day, I would like to honor women in our tradition, something we don't hear a lot about. And we were there in the beginning. We were there. And I'd just like to take a moment, if we could all just bring in whatever mother is to us. And I know that can be extremely complicated. But we all came from a body. Somebody carried us in their body that we can sit here today with whatever that was, whatever capacity. So just to take a moment and feel that in yourself. If you want to send a blessing or whatever you need to do or not do, just a moment for Mother, mothering, Mother Earth. Thank you. You can continue. So I'd like to bring in today Iron Groinstone Lou, one of my heavy metal aunts in the tradition. And this is Iron Groinstone's Lou's feast. It's in a couple collections. This is from The Hidden Lamp, a collection of stories that women put together, all stories about women in the tradition. Iron Groinstone Lu went to Master Guishan Lingyo. Guishan said, "Old cow, so you've come." The iron grinder said, "Tomorrow on Mount Wutai, there's a big gathering and feast. Are you going, teacher?" Guishan laid down and sprawled out. The iron grinder turned and left immediately. So that's the situation. Wan Yan Wu, who's a compiler in a Blue Cliff record of Koan collections, said, "The nun Iron Grindstone Lu was like a stone-struck spark, like a lightning flash. Hesitate and you lose your body and your life. She studied for a long time. Her active edge was sharp and dangerous." Guishan is over 600 miles from Mount Wutai. How then did Iron Grindstone Lu want to have Guishan go to the feast? It's not like we have subways and all that, you know, an airplane. They didn't have that in China. "Tell me, what was her meaning? This old lady understands Guishan's conversation. Fiber coming, thread going, one letting go, one gathering in. They answer back to each other like two mirrors complement each other. Phrase to phrase, they're in perfect accord. People these days can be poked three times and not turn their heads, but this old lady couldn't be fooled one little bit." So Iron Grindstone Lu, Liu Tiemo, we chanted her this morning, number 19 on the list of women ancestors, was probably the first named Zen woman I came across in training. And just her name I found fascinating. She wasn't grounding maize. She wasn't grounding coffee. She was grounding iron. Wow. No, not graham crackers. And her name was because in Dharma Encounter, it was said she could grind up any monastic male monk that came in front of her. So she got the name Iron Grindstone Lu. And as a woman, of course, studying with a male teacher, I was delighted to find someone like Iron Grindstone Lu. I was like, you're my auntie. And also to find her having this very deep and playful relationship with her teacher, which comes up a few times, Guishan. And in the Zen tradition, there's a lot of, or many formidable women teachers. But you have to search. It's becoming more available, but there wasn't a lot out at all when I found her to find anything about any of their lives and their stories as practitioners of the Buddha's Dharma. And even in the stories, we don't even know if they were actually women sometimes. We think they were, but they may not have been. So to understand better my story, evolving our story here as women in the tradition, to feel a bond, go back and forth with companions, it's important to get these stories, because stories, when people tell their stories, we get to hear them. And we know with our own, we're found in that moment. The story is important because we're found. We chant for all the realized women whose names have been forgotten or left unsung, and we sing them. We bring them forth. So they're here in this place, in this time, that literally they matter. We matter, each one of us. We matter. So they exist in the telling, and then they now exist in a community with others. So Ryu was her family name. Liu, Ryu was her family name, in Chinese pronounced Lu or Lo. And Ketsu means iron. Ma means mill. So it's a mill that grinds iron, her name. It appears she had her own temple and was considered equal to the male teachers of her time that she met. And as I said, she was known to grind up monks in Dharma Encounter. So we don't have many details about her life. And when I read some of the details, they often appear with a manly embodiment, with Zen transformations. So how can I have them as a role model when I don't know much about the model, other than they're here, they were found? We don't know how they were transformed or who they were before they came into practice. We do know much more about men in practice. So there's not much in the literature about how they found their way in difficult times, what their difficulties were. Like, you know, and I was like, I wanted to say like, hey, Grinder, like Auntie Grinder, what was it like having your period in Sesshin? Are you gay? Did you need more sleep on the schedule? How did that work for you? Did you ever want to get married? Did you want to have children? When did you decide you didn't want to have children? Was it for the Dharma? So we don't have anything like this about them. We are told these named people were women, but do not hear a hint sometimes of a female identity. And I've been looking. If anybody else has some stuff, give it to me. Their behavior, their life experience. But we have a lot of what we might call macho portraits of women. There's a certain name for them. So it's a a particular invitation for us women in this day to find our way. Miriam Levering, who's one of the great scholars of women in Buddhism, she said, "We always hear about women's contributions in male conquest language. We are without any images or archetypes of female or feminine Zen masters. While classic portrayals show Zen included women, patriarch Zen never became androgynous, incorporating the varied experience of both men and women as a way of enriching the tradition." How many contemporary women have it in them that they really wish to become transformed into female clones of their male Zen masters? Now, recently I agreed to an interview with Hemera Foundation, and they are now interviewing as many women Zen teachers as they can, female, to find out about their experience and write it down and start records. So I was happy to do that. We'll see what comes of it. It was a very enriching conversation for myself to even think about it and go over it. So we know there are women that were transformed by Zen, that served to transform Zen monks and served to highlight great Zen masters. So here's what we know about Iron Grindstone. She was born in 871, and her full name was Liu Tiemo. And in her young life, she was a peasant. And as the aristocracy is usually fattened, the peasants got steadily thinner. And she worked on a rich man's plot of land with her father. I didn't find anything about her mother. But it was backbreaking, endless work to bring soil in that was nutritious. They had to carry it on a wooden pole and chains up and down a mountain. Endless work. The sophisticated aristocratic women of the time read classics, wrote poetry, practiced music and calligraphy. They wore their hair tied up in buns with decorative pins, wore silk robes with elaborate decorative patterns made of silk. As a peasant, they were taxed on food, land, salt, incense, tea, all the provisions, clothing, alcohol, even spoons. Some babies were not allowed to live, and others were sold to debt slaves as soon as they were able to walk. She was described as being short, stout, plain, with big feet. Now, this big feet could just be normal feet because foot binding was very of the aristocratic class, so she may not have had her foot bound, which is why she had normal, fat, big feet. She had very bulbous, well-worked hands from the soil and the land. So it was hard for her to do the delicate work of sewing, playing the lute or the flute or calligraphy. And when she was old enough, she simply walked away from the work. She just walked. She left her father, it said, taking care of the plot. And she thought, if all life has to offer was hunger and work, at least she could choose where she would be hungry and where she would work. So she took matters into her own hands. She must have been a teenager or so. And it's written that she walked through Zhao Mountains, and she passed these giant rocks in the cliffs with Buddhas in them. The soil was ochre, smooth like clay, and often in the light, it was so filled with the particles of the clay that it was called like a golden light. That's what it looked like in the mist. And she would stop at convents for shelter. There were a lot of convents which were sanctuaries for women who were displaced, divorced, widowed, without children, because they had a hard time matriculating into society again and couldn't do certain things if they had been widowed and without children, women who were beaten by their husbands. And for this reason, many people thought the convents were quite unsavory places. And many of the nuns couldn't read or write, but they were safe and reliable places. And when she passed those carved statues, it said they made such an impression on her, seeing these Buddhas carved in the cliffs, that she really resonated with the serene faces surrounded with curly hair, different looks than anyone she had seen. Not sure who they might have been carved by. Their eyes lowered peacefully, sitting on lions, dragons, elephants, raging tsunamic waves, and very peaceful oceans. It reminded me of, I had an uncle I hadn't seen for a while, and I was invited to his house, and he had showcases of Buddhas. And I was just like, what? My uncle's got like Buddhas? Like, I didn't know this about him. And it turned out that during the war, he collected Buddha heads for the same reason. He was so searching. He was so struck by the eyes lowered and the serenity on the statue that it made him feel peaceful. So he started to collect them. And she imagined that perhaps she herself could sit with anything, with the same stillness in the midst of her poverty and pain and injustice. And then she wondered, can statues be teachers? Can statues be teachers? Those of you that have statues of any kind, do they teach you? Are they teachers? And I began to resonate with her question as I bow. It looks like a person sitting zazen. We put it on an altar and make offerings with the sincere wish to meet our awakened nature, an expression of identity. We get to identify. So what about these images? What happens when you bow in your mind to an image? When we put forth an inquiry or aspiration wholeheartedly, we might get the response. I talked yesterday about this silent response, so we can hear other things speak to us. In Merton's poem, I used, "Be still, listen to the stones of the wall, be silent. They try to speak your name. Listen to the living walls. Who are you? Who are you? Whose silence are you? Who? Be quiet. Are you as these stones are quiet? Do not think of what you are, still less of what you may one day be. Rather, be what you are. Be the unthinkable one you do not know. Oh, be still while you're still alive, all and all things live around you speaking. I do not hear to your own being, speaking by the unknown that is in you and in themselves." That resonated with me again, thinking about images and becoming the identity of these energies, aliveness. So maybe we have had this experience of inquiry where we could truly offer our respect and our reverence and really feel the response coming up together. And this koan definitely, definitely offers a model of respect and reverence going both ways between two people. When we sit down for Zazen and start working through all kinds of problems with the conceptual mind, eventually we catch ourselves. A little bit of intention arises to stop, and we settle right here, right now. A response comes. We catch it, and we take a deep breath of relaxation, ease, and presence, returning to breath. Buddha meets us and confirms we're on the right track. And baby bodhicitta is born. Bodhicitta, that aspiration to care, to appreciate the suffering, recognize it for oneself, and to want to alleviate it in oneself and for others in that moment. Mystical communication with inconceivable Buddha nature. The illusory sentient being we call me softens her grip, releasing to an enormous size. Enormous. Do you know you are so enormous? And this is what I think Liu Tiemo might have felt. Suddenly, she was enormous. Beyond her poverty, her pains, her all the injustices, she felt a bit of immensity. And her intention said, stay with this karma, stay with this. So she aimed for the city, Chang'an. She had never been to a city before. Let's check out New York. Never been here. And she came to the Water and Land Convent, which had more statues unlike any of the ones she had ever could imagine before. More statues, thousands of them, made in clay, covering every wall, recreating the story of the Buddha's life. And she stood there transfixed, taking them in slowly, every detail, the whole story of the Buddha, seeing how alive the figures were. Somebody breathed life into them, and how they grew up the wall into the darkness and disappeared in the peak of the ceiling behind the beams. Figures reading scrolls, speaking, sitting in pagodas, riding horses, swans, surrounded by arhats, wild, multi, fiery-haired protector demons. Can you imagine? All going up the wall, just standing there, staring at this wall. She saw her own life, her father's, her grandfather's. She realized how ordinary harm was, how ordinary evil had become, could be, how inattentive and distant. She saw the power of not being afraid to die. She felt refuge, protection. And she said she sat there on a cold mat in a cold hall by candlelight in silence and followed her breaths between lives. So she went into the city because she wanted to explore more. It had 81 monasteries and 28 convents. Can you imagine like going through New York and having 81 monasteries, 28 convents? She saw the city, and then she realized, I'm through with it. It held no interest, apparently. And she entered the nearest convent and asked if she could be ordained. And eventually the nuns obliged. And then she said, I need to search further for this Buddha way that I saw. And she met Guishan. And he was the Dharma heir of Yakujo. Baijiang and the Fox is a famous koan who received transmission from Master Basso, Mazu. Mazu was said to have 84 enlightened disciples. Yakujo transmitted to Obaku, who started his own school, which was the only art school in the tradition. It was based on the Shakuhachi. Okay, so I was looking for the clay school when I first got to Zen. Isn't there a clay school? That line that started, like people working in clay? No, it was the Shakuhachi. And he transmitted to Isan, who, along with his Dharma heir Kyogen, became another line. I'm saying all this because five houses of Zen developed in China at that period, and one of those houses was the Tozan and Soto school, which is our Rinzai Soto lineage that you are sitting within the practice of, and the forms have changed, but it's alive and well today. And she found Guishan and became his student and became his 43rd Dharma heir. And Guishan is the other person in this koan. So going back to it, koans are one of the many tools available for Zen teachers to help their students find a way to live in the world of the absolute and the relative. And we can't retreat into emptiness and pretend that difference doesn't matter. In difference, we need to see the truth of how worlds meet. So it's the two arrows meeting in midair, which I think you can feel perhaps this conversation totally embodies. It doesn't rely on words. It relies on what's happening with these people. Of course, in the relative reality, everything can be compared with other things. Snow and rain, sun and moon, left and right, up and down. But in the absolute, of course, all distinctions disappear, like we chant in the Heart Sutra. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no color, sound, smell. But to encounter the absolute is not yet enlightenment. It has to merge with the differences in the relative world. So they are having a deep conversation and connection in bodily actions. Enkyo Sensei, in her commentary on this koan, said, this exchange is perfect, satisfyingly complete, and heartbreakingly intimate. Iron Grindstein Liu went to Master Guishan Ling Yao. Guishan said, "Old cow, so you've come." The iron grinder said, "Tomorrow on Mount Wutai, there's a big gathering and feast. Are you going, teacher?" Guishan laid down, sprawled out, and the iron grinder turned and immediately left. That's the whole koan. So where is the feast, I ask you? Where is this feast? Where is this mountain? His laying down, her leaving him. Are you coming or are you going? Master Baswi said, "At birth, not a single atom comes into being. At death, not a single atom departs." Who are we? Nothing comes at birth, nothing departs at death. Are you coming or going? Guishan is the teacher I always quote when somebody asks me, "Does Zen believe in reincarnation?" Why? Well, Guishan's calling her old cow. Now, if I came here and somebody said old cow, I don't know how I would do with that at this age. I wonder what the feedback would be. But in this relationship, it functions as a recognition of sameness, because Guishan said in another koan, one day, he identified with being a water buffalo. You may know this. And he said, that was the form. One day you will find me in front of this monastery and I will be reborn as a water buffalo. So he's calling her an old cow because he's speaking of the sameness. We're both cows in this. The male buffalo and the female cow meet and they're ready to engage. So the iron grinder said, tomorrow on Mount Utai, there's a big gathering and feast. Are you going, teacher? And he laid down and sprawled out. There's only one detail in the story that's important to know, which is a geographical fact, which I told you. Mount Utai is 600 miles or more from where Guishan was living. How's he going to go tomorrow? How's he going to go get there for this? What a ridiculous question in the first place. She knows how far he is. So how then did Iron Grindstone Lu want to have Guishan go to the feast? Tell me, what was her meaning? So I ask you again, where is the gathering? Where do we gather this feast? Where is this place? This place where the feast is to be celebrated. Is it 600 miles away? This is not 600 miles away. Even if by a geographical and conventional language, it is 600 miles away. We chanted this morning in the identity of relative, if you do not see the way, you do not see it even as you walk on it. When you walk the way, it is not near, it is not far. If you are deluded, you are mountains and rivers away from it. Where is this place in the actual world, here, now? Where is Mount Utai in Brooklyn? Don't go too far. Then the end of your nose. Even if we were physically at the feast at Mount Utai, we would still be here. Same place that we are here now, in our body. As we take an inhale and an exhale, we can only be here. You know, there's that movie Postcards from the Edge that came up to me, and she writes, having a lovely time, wish I was here. That's how we live. Even if you're at home, in the office, with your children, this is the place where the feast is happening, always. Wherever I am always in the same place. And I was reminded of I went to a mime school, some of you know this, I love the story. It was called Le Center du Silence. And it was in Colorado. But it was before I came to the monastery, and I was like, I want to go to the center of silence. That's what it means. I went, and there was a very elusive instruction. Go to the pink mailbox on the corner, wait for this covered wagon type bus to take you to where you need to go. And I was like, this is starting off pretty damn good. I like this. Pink mailbox. And I got there, it was a brutally hot day, and there was another woman there, and she was like mumbling, what's this pink mailbox stuff? I don't know what I'm doing. I said, are you going to Le Centre du Silence? She says, yeah, I'm going there. I said, me too. She goes, what's with the pink mail? I was delighted. She was just fit to be tied, hot. And I fell in love with her right away. You know how there's some people that really complain a lot? but they're so lovable at the same time. Like, you just love them, even though every word out of their mouth is just complaints. There's something just so endearing, and I loved her, and she made me very quiet because she was so busy complaining. So we went, this vehicle came, which was the cross between a covered wagon, a truck, and a jitney, if you've seen them in Atlantic City. And we bumbled up this mountain pass and suddenly come out into this modern urban neighborhood. I thought I was like going back to like the woods, and like we pop out in this like regular neighborhood, like Leave It to Beaver kind of thing. And it was a kid bouncing a ball, playing his, and Oliver North was on doing the hearings for Watergate. Everything was like very quiet but pronounced. The guy was working on his car, and I could hear like every hammer on his axle, like it was just, and this radio going, and she's like going on and on. Where is this thing? Where? What do we do? So we come to this driveway, and there's a bunch of people out there, and of course there's a guy in a striped shirt, suspenders, and I was like, gotta be the mime school, you know. And there's nothing. It's just a house. And so she blurts out, "Where is Le Centre du Silence?" And this little man comes appropriately. He's very tiny. And he looks at her in her eyes and puts his hand appropriately right here and says, "Mademoiselle, where is Le Centre du Silence?" And she just went, "Ooh." And I was like, okay, it's getting better. Where is the feast? Where is Mount Wutai? In past, present, and future, that is constantly being recalibrated. It defies all our ideas and desires. Think of all the suffering we endure in a lifetime, wanting things to be other than what they are. I want to be different. I want this to be different. I want it to be different. I want you to be different. So I don't have to be different. That's how we suffer. The times we're so convinced that some external or internal situation was so horrible and completely unacceptable when we wanted to go to Mount Wutai. When we wanted to go to Mount Wutai. But there was no way we could get there. Full of regret and anguish, and there was absolutely nothing we can do with about it. Because we can't get there. How do we get there if we're already there? Where are we going? But Guishan knows better. Guishan. He offers us his ease. He turns and stretches out for a nap. He simply lies down in reality. "Teacher, are you going to the feast tomorrow?" Whoosh, whoosh, off she goes. Guishan has made an accurate hit himself. Two arrows have met in midair. The mist is dissipated. Any confusion is set aside. Mount Wutai, right there. The grindstone packs up and goes home. Mount Wutai swings around on her feet into her steps. There's nothing more to say. That's the celebration. The commentary says, "We see the capacity to quickly transform from oneness to differentiation at the moment the situation pivots. Everything balances on a fine point, ready to change in a heartbeat." And isn't that our study? Isn't that our study? Liberating self in liberation of all beings. Seeing that ground, who we are, that nature, that absolute nature. And then that has to go into differentiation. And that's really the work. We can't go to Mount Wutai. We can't go to another feast. Learning to live in both worlds of oneness and form so we can move together. As my teacher used to say, no small thing to be born human. Guishan and Grindstone are completely and utterly in union with one another. And there's no record, but it's said that at the time he might have been 83 years old. He lived actually pretty long for that time. And after this encounter, it said they probably never saw each other again because he may have died shortly after the encounter. Whether they did or not doesn't really make a difference, whether we do or not with anyone, if we can help but not always see one another. That's the key for this and me. How can we all live together that we can't all help but see one another? How can I live where I can't help but always see another as myself? And when we have confidence in this, then nothing whatsoever is missing. Even our anguish and our suffering is complete as it is. So let's enter the world today, perhaps really letting in that we are each the world. We are each the world, the totality. Happy Mother's Day. Enjoy the mothering. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the Monastery Store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.